for this episode. Probably the person who kept me the most mentally sane in grad school. The author of We Want Fish Sticks, the bizarre and infamous rebranding of the New York Islanders, which just became available on Amazon on December 1st. Doctor, and it's good to finally say that to you, buddy. Dr. Nick Hershon, lifelong New York Islanders fan. Buddy, how we doing?
Very good, Shane. It's good to see you again. It's been a while, right?
You too,
it's been like,
man.
What, more than 2 years now?
Yeah, it's been a minute, man. It's good to put that doctor in front of your name finally.
Yeah, it still seems weird when I get like students saying like doctor, and I'm like, oh, wait a second. For years, I used to get that when I was like an adjunct professor or even teaching at Ohio University.
Right.
And then it'd be like, you know, kind of a fun twist. But now it's like, oh, it's for real.
Are you one of those guys who, like, if they don't call you doctor, it drives you insane because of how much work you put in to get the title?
No, not at all. You know, they call a professor, whatever. Some people just call me doc or just have students, whatever they want to call me. You know, it's fine as long as it's respectful. And usually it's pretty good.
I love it. But yeah, the reason why I say that Nick's the guy that kept me sane is because in our program, you were the only one that had anything really in common with me at all, since we could always talk hockey. We would sit in these 4-hour lectures and I would have no clue what was going on. And then, like, finally we'd break and you and I could talk hockey a little bit, and it was nice just to be able to catch up. So a little academic background. This is a change of pace for this podcast. We've had a lot of former players, former coaches. The reason why I wanted to reach out to you, Nick, is because you're like a hockey historian at this point, definitely the most academic person. I think that you have more degrees than every other guest on this show combined. So that's a good title.
Yeah, and I got my last one for writing a dissertation with We Want Fish Sticks in the title, so I don't know what that means, but yeah.
So bachelor's from St. John's, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Master's from Columbia, which is just an unreal school, and I didn't even get – I actually applied to get my undergrad there, and I think they laughed at it and shredded it. And then your PhD from the best school in the world, Ohio University.
Of course, yeah. Go OU.
So my first real question for you is, you know, you've been a hockey fan forever. Where did your, you know, kind of your love for the game originate on the island?
Yeah, so it's kind of weird to think about it now because I feel like I've been a hockey fan for so long as part of my identity, but I really didn't become an Islanders fan until 1999, which is I was already 13, 14 years old at that time. And it was just, it was kind of like that's the year I really became a sports fan in general. I was starting to watch the Mets games that summer. The Mets went to the playoffs and I was a big baseball fan, you know, starting then. And, yes, that was an exciting series. And then getting into the fall, I don't know exactly what it was, but my dad had grown up on Long Island. My grandparents still lived there when I was growing up. And so we'd go to visit them every weekend and we'd always pass by Nassau Coliseum where the Islanders played. And I just started getting curious about it. And as I learned more about the fact that, like, the top players in the NHL were coming to this arena. Granted, they weren't playing for the Islanders at that time, but just the fact that they were like visiting and like, you know, to think of like Mario Lemieux and Wayne Gretzky were like stopping by Nassau Coliseum was just a bizarre thought given the way the arena looked and everything. And then the Islanders were a terrible team back then, 99, 2000, last place team, not a lot of bright spots, but just starting to go to those games and hearing the sounds of the skates against the ice and the action. And it's one of those games you really have to experience. You know, right. Seeing it on TV is just not the same. So I fell in love with it. It was a good thing to do in the baseball offseason at the start. And then it just became a kind of love for me. And the Islanders had a bit of a renaissance the next few years after that. So it was fun to watch.
The Mets and the Islanders, that's a tough draw.
Yeah, it is. I was attracted to underdog teams, and that was part of what drew me to the Mets. You know, I'm from Queens, where the Mets were. So there was part of that, too. But I grew up in an era when, you know, the Yankees were winning. The Yankees had won in 96. They're about to win again, you know, beat the Mets in the World Series in 2000 and all that. But the same thing with the Islanders. It was just they're not the team that people think of in the New York market. We have an original six franchise in New York that had won the cup in 94 and was the toast of the town and all that. But that's why I like that the Islanders were still like somehow surviving on Long Island. And to their credit, I mean, they had one of the greatest dynasties in hockey history in the early 1980s, four straight Stanley Cups. But I kind of like that they were the gritty underdog team that you don't hear as much about.
Right, yeah. When I started, you know, rooting for the Penguins, because I grew up in Michigan but was between them and Pittsburgh my whole life, it was kind of the same thing. The Lemieux era, well, he had retired, and then he had to come back to save the team. And people don't really remember it now because they've been good for so long. They used to suck. You know, back in the Rico Fada, Chris Beach days, that seems like yesterday to me. I mean, obviously, there's the whole conspiracy that, you know, the league handed us Crosby, and it's kind of over from there. But that's like, I'm with you, man. I was kind of the same way. And the Islanders have had, you know, many resurgences. They've had some good teams, too. I have to ask you about Tavares, though. You're the first Islanders fan, maybe the like the biggest Islanders fan I know. I have to ask you about your opinion on John Tavares.
It was really rough because this whole summer was a roller coaster, I felt. You know, they fired Garcineau, their general manager, for 12 years. And it just finally we see some light. You know, this guy who hadn't been able to get us, you know, into the playoffs or really, you know, deep into the playoffs, certainly during his time here. And then they hire Lou Lamoriello as their general manager, Hall of Famer. They get Barry Trotz as their head coach right off the Stanley Cup champion Capitals. They start talking about a deal for a new arena at Belmont. So all these positive things are happening, and then the Tavares deadline comes up, and we've been talking about this as Islanders fans for a few years about what's going to happen summer of 2018, how's this going to go. But every report was that he was going to stay, pretty much, if you looked on Twitter and all these guys supposedly in the know. But then to actually hear him saying he's going to leave, it was such a gut punch, and it was really depressing for a few days, just like, you know, because your emotions are tied into this. And like, you know, I go to so many games a season and watch all the others and everything. So to think about like one of your top players leaving, and he had been there for so long. I was at Nassau Coliseum on the night that John Tavares was drafted. I was at the draft party, and you can see that video online, and fans are just so excited in that moment, right. And the whole crowd goes into applause immediately. And then I was there when he scored his first goal, which was against the Penguins, actually, the 2009 season. So he just became the whole identity of that franchise. I have a John Tavares jersey, I have a poster. So to see him then walk away, it was just a really tough time, and a lot of the Islanders fans are still trying to get over it, but thankfully they've been playing so well. That's been easier to stomach, you know?
Yeah, we've talked a lot on the pod about just how deep the talent pool is around the world now. And I actually called Tavares going to Toronto a few months before he did. And then once Toronto started making like little moves that weren't really hitting news wires and you could see they were freeing space up, I was like, here it comes. Here it comes. Yeah. He's going to go. And it's unfortunate. Like I said, as I'm a Penguins fan, but I'm a Lions fan in the NFL, and it, you know, it's like when Barry Sanders and Calvin Johnson both retired early, given thank God I don't have to watch him play for another team. You know, I kind of know what you mean. You build a franchise around them, and then right in their prime, they leave. It's just an absolute gut punch. I'm with you. They made some good management moves, too. I really thought that they made the best push they could to keep him. And it's unfortunate what happened, but they have a lot of young talent to build around. They've been the surprise in the Metro for sure so far this season. I'm sure then it's not Tavares. Who's your favorite Islanders player of all time?
I mean, of all time, I'd have to go back to players of my childhood or, you know, the first years that I was rooting for a team. It would have to be Mariusz Tchaikovsky. I know that's probably an unlikely pick. But in 1999-2000, he was one of the only guys on that team who was like a consistent scorer. He ended the season with 35 goals. And I remember reading an article around the time that said, the Islanders have never gone a season in their history without having a player score a hat trick. And heading into their final game of that 99-2000 season, they didn't have a hat trick. And I had tickets to, it was Fan Appreciation Day at Nassau Coliseum, and sure enough, Tchaikovsky scores three goals against the hat trick in the last game. And it was really exciting, and I just remember watching in warm-ups. It seemed like even in warm-ups, he was the only guy like getting the puck past the Islanders goalie in the warm-up. So, you know, and he made the All-Star team when I was a fan. I didn't grow up with cable TV, and so the only time I could even see an Islanders player on TV was when they had the NHL All-Star game. I think it was on ABC, right. And Tchaikovsky playing that. And then he was still around when they made the playoffs, you know, the first time in many years in 2002. So for me, he's got to be number one. I'm still thinking about how I could do like some sort of book or academic project where I get the chance to, you know, an excuse to kind of interview him.
Right.
Because I just you know, remember him so well. So yeah, it's an odd pick, you know. But
I love it though. It's unorthodox.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I still have my jersey. And now that I can't wear my John Tavares jersey to the games anymore, right, probably going to be showing up with Mario Tchaikovsky a few times, number 21 a few times this season.
I love it. Yeah, we'll branch into your book. So it started as a dissertation. I know that's a common thing for the dissertation turns into a book deal. I know my listeners, and I know a lot have not been through grad school, but, you know, so as a master's student, you have to write a thesis, which I did. It was about 130 pages. I did mine on alcohol advertising during the NHL and NBA playoffs, where I had to watch hundreds of hours of commercials, and it was miserable. But it was funny because I had to DVR every game, and DVR was made to skip the commercials and watch the game, and I had to DVR everything and skip the game and watch all the commercials. So my roommate at the time kind of hated me because I was doing that literally for 3 months. That thesis took me an entire summer, and that was just a master's thesis. Where did the idea for the rebrand, you know, on the Fisherman logo, where did it originally start? And, you know, how much work did you do until you were kind of like, yeah, I could actually turn this into a 300-plus page dissertation?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking when I entered my graduate program, you know, when I entered the doctoral program, about what could I do as the dissertation? Because it's supposed to be this project that becomes kind of how you're defined in the academic industry. You know, you become an expert in this area, and people are going to be talking to you about it for decades, hopefully.
Right.
So you really want to pick something that you love, that you're passionate about. So for me, you know, I toyed around with a few other subjects, but something baseball or hockey was going to be number one. And even though I love the Mets, I go to tons of their games, hockey's still got to be number one. It's a niche sport, and I like that kind of subculture of it. And I just have so many positive associations with growing up watching those teams. So I just kind of thought, okay, what can I do with the Islanders that hasn't been told before? And obviously, the 1980s teams have been overdone.
Right.
Been a few books written about them, and, you know, I also just wasn't around when, you know, I wasn't even alive when they last won the Stanley Cup, so I didn't experience that. What I knew a little bit about was just hearing about the Fisherman jersey, certainly going to tons of games where I saw fans wearing that jersey, and not really knowing the full story, just people saying like, ah, yeah, it was a mockery of the game, it was this really stupid thing. So I kind of wanted to dig deeper there, and knowing that. So it was the mid-90s, so most of the guys who were on that team, all the guys that I know of who were on those teams are still alive. All the people who were involved in the rebranding at that point were still alive. So it's a good time to do interviews with them. Mm-hmm. You know, go back to the newspaper archives, and I looked at the Daily News, Newsday, the Post, the New York Times, went to the TV archives to get some of their old game broadcasts, looking up stuff on YouTube, buying old game programs on eBay or asking fans on Twitter. And I was kind of well connected there because I knew a bunch of those fans and reporters when I was a reporter for the Daily News myself. So, yeah, it just seemed like there was a story where there were enough of the kind of tools in place, enough of the sources still around that I could put this together. And it was going to entertain me during the entire time doing research because, you know, you got to love it. If you're going to be doing – and for me it was – one solid year pretty much every single day of doing some part of the research or the writing. And then even before that and after that, there's of course a little bit of the research and then doing the book contract process and now all the promotion for it, doing all these book talks. Like, you really gotta be excited about this. So it had all of the elements of what I wanted in the story.
Yeah, people don't understand how much work it really takes unless you've done it. Me writing my thesis is what made me not want to get my doctorate, because I was like, I can't do this again. You know, it wasn't the classes or teaching. Like, I really enjoyed teaching, and I helped with the sports writing class at OU when I was a master's student. And I was like, after my thesis was done, I didn't even want to. Like, I got invited to some conferences and stuff. I'm like, nope. I'm just done. I can't do it anymore. So that's the first thing I wanted to just kind of let all the listeners know, is how much work it takes to do something like this. You know, just kind of, you know, go over that process a little bit more detailed. You know, kind of, obviously I know it could take all day. It took you a year or so, like you said, start to finish. You know, what's that process every day like? You know, in the beginning, were you kind of like, this is never going to be over?
No, I mean, I kind of had a disciplined approach to it. So essentially, I wanted to do it in one academic year. So I left my last year of my 3-year doctoral program only was going to be dissertation, and I taught a course each semester. So it was just one course.
That's exactly what I did for my master's thesis. Yeah, except it was a summer, not a whole year. But yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I thought would make the most sense, not take any other courses or have any other sorts of complications there. You know, some people are on the job market while they're doing it, and I was towards the end, but that wasn't so bad. So it was mostly that fall semester of 2015. I devoted entirely to the research. It was all identifying the players, identifying all the executives, anybody who I might want to try to interview, and start reaching out to them. And I started doing some of that in the summer of 2015, but really got going in the fall. So then it's doing all of those interviews. And again, I did 53 of them, I believe, for the book, and transcribing the interviews, which I did all by hand by myself, you know, which was very tedious because some of these interviews lasted anywhere from 30 minutes to the longest one, I think, was 4.5 hours, which I did with an NHL executive at the time, you know, talking to him about it. So, you know, but you're transcribing every second of that, making sure you're getting the words correct. You have people with thick accents from Russia or Europe or Canada. You know, I had to transcribe A like 55 million times in all of these. But, you know, and I really want to get it accurately done. And then there's, you know, beyond that, it's just like tracking down, okay, any other possible source. How do I get a hold of these programs? Like I said before, you know, trying to go all over eBay, ask the Ohio University Library, can you help me get this stuff? All of the microfilm that I had to go through, reels and reels of microfilm. I was in the basement at Alden Library at Ohio University for hours on end, going through like every single issue of Newsday, which was Long Island's daily newspaper, trying to see any article they may have written about the Islanders. So yeah, it was a lot of that work that was kind of tedious at times, I guess, but for me, it was still exciting because as I was reading these old newspaper articles, I'm seeing some of the wild stuff that went on and the monkey business that was going on in the executive offices and Mike Milbury as the coach and general manager of the Islanders. He's making these zany trades. He's saying outrageous things to the media. He's shoving and spitting at players. Then you have John Spano becomes the owner of the Islanders.
My favorite documentary.
Yeah.
It's the 30 for 30 on John Spano. It's my favorite one.
Yeah, so it's called Big Shot. ESPN did it actually while I was working on my dissertation. And so I use that as one of the sources too. But, you know, he ends up being outed as a con artist, of course, and has to give up his ownership of the team and ends up going to prison. So, you know, as I was reading all that stuff, and then in the spring of 2016, as I was writing all of it, it still got my attention. It was still something that I thought, this is such a fun story, and I can't believe that no one has told it yet. Because there were so many beat writers for the team at that time that I figured one of them might have said, you know, I know all the players. I've got all my notes from that era. I'm going to do this. And yeah, I still just enjoyed every day diving into it and be like, what story am I going to tell next? And how am I going to tell it the right way? It is a lot of work. And it is one of those things where, you know, you got to have very understanding family and friends. And, you know, you get together with me at like bizarre hours, unconventional situations. I can only spend 30 minutes here, or, you know, only maybe one day a week when I can really do anything. And even that one day, I'm still like spending the majority of it doing research, or writing. But yeah, but it was still cool. And even now, like it's fun to talk about it after doing all that work. Some people hate the projects they do as a dissertation, but I'm cool with still talking about it.
That's awesome. So you said 50 plus interviews. Who was maybe the best person you interviewed or your favorite interview?
The goalies for the team were really cool. I interviewed Eric Fichaud, who ended up writing the foreword of the book, and he's a hockey
analyst. Saw that. That's so cool. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it was awesome to get a hold of him. Because, you know, again, I don't know, when I was going into this project, I didn't really know a lot of these guys really well. They weren't on the team anymore by the time that I was rooting for them in 99. Only one or two of them were. Nicholas Anderson, who was on the team in that period, I interviewed him. And so that was kind of a thrill for me just because I remembered him being on the team when I was growing up. But yeah, Eric Fichaud, just a very outgoing guy and had a lot of interesting memories of the team. Tommy Soderstrom, who was also a goalie on that team and also had been a goalie with the Flyers and kind of best known for wearing this big mask at the time, covered, you know, his face with the lattice kind of structure. And but he was also just a kind of a funky player and got into a goalie fight back in that era and had a lot of negative things to say about Mike Milbury. He was not ashamed to say that all of. The guys I spoke to seemed to be very diplomatic, politically correct, and they didn't know me from Adam, so I understood that they weren't necessarily going to like start trashing their former coach, who still is in hockey today, so they don't want to say that.
I don't know how.
Yeah.
I'll trash Mike Milbury every episode of this podcast. I hate that clown.
Yeah, kind of amazingly. But so a few of them did like say some negative things or just give me some insights into what was going on in the locker room with Milbury. But with Tommy Sagstrom just revealing some of his opinions and Rich Pilon, who was a defenseman on that Islanders team. And it was really funny because I asked him at one point in our interview, I was asking all the guys, like, do you still have your fisherman jersey to this day? Because the Islanders fans think about this jersey as being a mockery of the Islanders brand, and why would they ever wear it? And so you would think, well, maybe the players didn't even save it because they thought it was such an embarrassment. So I asked every single player I interviewed at the end. First of all, I asked some of them about Mike Milbury, but I would also ask them, like, okay, do you still have your fisherman jersey? And a lot of them said they had it framed up somewhere special. They gave it to their dad, or they gave it to their kids or something like that. And then Rich Pilon said, yeah, I have it in my closet. I still like to wear it. My wife likes me to wear it to bed. And he like paused. And I thought, like, is this for real? And then, like, after a few seconds, he, like, starts laughing. Ah, I'm just kidding with you, man. You know,
funny.
But I'm just joking about that. So that was kind of a memorable moment. A lot, like, interviewing hockey players was one of the really fun parts of this, is that
they're the best. They are.
Yeah. And, like, they're just so open and available. And a lot of these guys, you know, I guess they haven't had the media spotlight on them in decades. So they're just, like, kind of, you know, enjoying the fact that you're actually asking them stuff. And I did a lot of research before each interview so I could ask specific questions, not just like, hey, what'd you think of this logo? Because then I would have gotten the exact same response, like, you know, 50 times from all these guys.
Right.
So I asked them more about, you know, specifically like, okay, like in this game, I saw that you scored a goal or you said this after the game. And can you talk more about that and your relationship with certain players or coaches? And just doing those interviews, transcribing them was hell. And then thinking about, you know, I just did like a four hour interview. Oh my God, now I'm going to have to transcribe that whole thing. And now I would just like pay for it. But the actual conducting interviews was so much fun. I kept like being like, I can't believe I'm getting all these great insights and I'm going to be able to put it into this book later on. It was really fun to put that together.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because we joke about a lot on here how NHL players will give the most generic in-between period interviews. Every game, it's the same thing. They're like, oh, you had a good first period. What happened? Oh, we had our feet moving. We got the puck deep. We got to be physical. Stay out of the box. And it's the same exact interview. And you're right, man. That's a good way to go about it, is to kind of pry into, you know, more specific things. Because you're right. It's the hockey guys are the best. I mean, 95% of the professional athletes that I've ever interviewed were hockey players, because that's the only sport I've really covered full time since I was really 19. So, I mean, they're the best. They're the most genuine guys, as long as you don't like try to pry at them. But you know what I mean? They're the most genuine guys. Besides the guys that you personally interviewed, have any other former players reached out to you at all? Like, I saw that some of the old guys tweeted about the book and stuff like that. Have you heard from any of the other players back in that era?
Actually, Scott Mayfield, who currently plays for the Islanders, tweeted, I was shocked about this, it was like a week or two ago, where he tweeted something about time for a quick hockey history lesson. Yeah. And he tweeted a photo of the book and he tagged me. And I'm like, oh my God, an Islanders player, like 14-year-old Nick would be like, are you kidding me?
Right.
A current guy who plays defense for the Islanders is like tweeting at me. So I like, tweeted back, like, you're like officially one of my two favorite players, Eric Fichaud, who wrote the forward, now being the other, because you know, he agreed to do that. And he's just such a cool guy. I've had, you know, the guy who played the Islanders mascot in that period. He follows me on Twitter.
We spoke
together for the book. Actually just put a copy of the book in the mail to send out to him. And I was tweeting at him right before I came on your podcast. So, Rob DiFiore, he's a really cool guy. And, you know, through the promotion of the book, some people are starting to come out through the woodwork, not necessarily players, but just like a third guy who played the Islanders mascot, who I actually didn't know that he played the mascot. And I would have interviewed him, but he came out of the woodwork the other day and emailed me like to talk more about some of the things that are in the book. And of course, Eric Fichaud wrote the forward. He tweeted at me the other day about it. So it's kind of cool to think that these guys are now reading about this. And, you know, they knew obviously what was happening on the ice and some of the stuff that was going on in the locker room, but they didn't know a lot of the context of what was happening with why the logo was chosen and maybe the struggles of the mascot, some of the ownership stuff that was going on with Spano. So it's in a weird way, like I'm even filling them in on kind of the behind the scenes stuff that even they didn't know.
Yeah, the ownership, the relationship between ownership and players is very, very robust in the fact that, like, it's so separate. You know what I mean? Owners/GM/coaches will go into the room and talk to the players and say one thing and give one message. And then when you're in, you know, a room with just the coaches or just the GMs, it's a whole different conversation. I experienced it when I played juniors with our management. It's pretty incredible because a lot of the players, it's just, they don't want anything to do with it. They're like, I'm just going to play, especially when you get into the professional guys or really any level where you're getting paid. So they had to, that had to be something for the players to be able to get the other side of some of the situations going on during that time when they weren't really Stanley Cup contenders back then.
Yeah. I mean, Mick Fakoda, who I interviewed for the book, and he was one of the Islanders enforcers at the time, and he's still their all time leader in penalty minutes. And I interviewed him for the book, and then I asked him would he write a blurb for the book. And in his blurb, he described, which is like just the kind of industry speak, that little paragraph they put in the back of the book where famous people say something positive to try to encourage people to buy the book. And he mentioned like, now I have a much better understanding of what was going on, because you wouldn't know this whole struggle they had about. They're trying to make more money as a small market team. They can't afford to buy good players or make upgrades to their arena. So they're looking for anything else they can. And changing your jersey is a quick way to make some money. No matter what you change it to, people are going to buy the jersey. And one of the interesting things I found in my research is that even though we view the Fisherman logo rebrand as this failure, the Islanders actually did go up in jersey sales in that 95-96 season.
Yeah.
So, of course, even if fans say like, it's this trash logo, it looks like the Gordon's Fisherman, it sucks. And then they go around and they buy it because they just want to support the team. They want the cool new thing. So there were a lot of those kinds of interesting stories. And I just love that aspect of thinking, I want to tell the fans some story that they haven't really heard. They haven't heard all of this context. And if some of the players themselves don't know some of the things that I'm revealing to them, can you imagine what the fan who wasn't in the locker room for this? I mean, this is all like brand new stuff to them, or things that maybe they read about in Newsday at the time, but they don't really remember, they saw on the broadcast. So that's what motivated me through that whole project, was just this idea of I'm writing it for these guys in the Nassau Coliseum stands. When you go to these games, I remember just how emotional these games are, as an Islanders fan. And I want to make sure I gave them the best product possible.
I love it. Well, how about you? You want to go into this little media tour that you've been on? What's that been like? Like I said, just real quick, it's got to be a whole new experience.
Yeah, it's really weird. I mean, I had a few books I've written before that had very little bit of like media attention. And I wrote a book about Nassau Coliseum, the Islanders Arena, was actually my first ever book. So there was that. But there wasn't the kind of attention that this has gotten. So it's been a lot of jumping on podcasts like yours, doing interviews with the likes of Newsday, the New York Post, pretty much everybody coming out, and then doing a book tour, which I'm about to start this Saturday. I have my first appearance. I'm going to a library in Queens, New York to talk about it. And then I have, I think it's five now, different events throughout Queens, Long Island, Manhattan. One is a block away from Madison Square Garden before an Islanders Rangers game there. So that'll
sick.
Be kind of wild. And and it's just also cool because the interaction now in this age of like social media, when my previous books came out, I wasn't quite as active as I am now on social media. So knowing how to put like in the Islanders hashtag, who to tag, different mentioning like Islanders beat reporters or whoever to kind of get them to circulate stuff, and just having all these fans come out and share memories, share photos, stories, and some of the stuff that I wish I could have included in the book. A few people are sharing photos of them with the players or with the mascot at the time. That's really cool. So some days it is like a whirlwind, and in the last like 2 weeks, I don't know, I've probably done like 20 interviews for different radios on TSN radio in Edmonton.
I saw that. It's awesome.
So it's like, and that was one, I don't even know how they found out about it. They just somehow,
I'm pretty sure this podcast has about as many listeners as TSN Edmonton. I'm pretty sure it's close.
Yeah, I mean, and I love talking about it to anybody,
Yeah.
I've been with a lot of fans. I mean, you know, guys who appreciate hockey, you just want to talk to people who really respect this because I put a lot of work into it.
Right.
And then you want it to just like, oh yeah, the book comes out and like for a week people are excited and then it goes away. No one really buys it. It's like, you know, man, I spent like a solid like year really working on this very intensely. Like I lost so many hours where I could have been sleeping or having fun or doing something else. You know, I was like not even able to go to the games or watch the games because I was researching the Islanders.
Right.
So it was like, you know, to be able to have a little bit of that attention right now. And I hope that then anybody who would be interested, you know, now knows about it. Because my previous books, I worried like people didn't even know that I wrote about Nassau Coliseum. And that frustrated me because I tried to do some promotion. So now I want to make sure that anybody who would possibly be interested in this topic, they know this book is out there. It's just on them now to kind of, you know, go out and pick it up.
I gotcha. So before I let you go, I just want to know what your favorite OU memory is. Majority of my listeners are OU grads. It's my favorite place on earth. A little bit out of left field. And you were there for a few years. What is your favorite OU memory?
Oh, man. I mean, this is, well, it could be kind of sappy. I mean, probably my favorite one is, so when I was there, I didn't even know they had this award for outstanding graduate student teaching, you know, because I was teaching there as a doctoral student. And then I got an email one day about, you know, you've been nominated by your students as like a finalist for this award. And then you had to go through this interview process if you wanted to, you know, I had to go in front of like this boardroom of like, I don't know, six or seven undergrads interviewing you about like, what are you like as a teacher? And why do you think your students nominated you for this award? So just finding out that the students themselves nominated me and like reading the nominations themselves, which was just crazy. And so like sweet. And then to actually win the award. So I ended up being like the first one to, you know, first mass communication PhD person to win that award in like a decade. And, you know, and have my professors there for it and talk to my parents about it. And then, you know, I still have that award up in my office and I have tons of different awards from like, you know, from OU and, you know, just my diplomas and stuff. And I have my Ivy League diploma from Columbia or whatever. But to me, that's probably like the most meaningful thing that I have. And I had the, you know, that moment was like recorded and I posted it up on YouTube because I had my friend like record it. So I know it's kind of like a sappy thing. It's not like a wild thing. I wasn't doing, you know, wild things. I was a PhD student. I was an undergrad. So I don't have like some crazy like story from the bars or any sort of thing like that. It's all like stories about like nerding out in Alden Library and, you know, hanging out in our classes and stuff.
Well, you definitely set a different tone as a professor from the journalism school that stood out. You interact with your students better than any professor I've ever seen does. You know what I mean? And it's not like a lot of times when professors try to interact with students, especially on social media, it comes off as like a creepy way. You know what I mean? But you do a great job of engaging your students and interacting them. The story, this is the only time I had the opportunity to tell this story since you were also an academic. So I got the date wrong for, what's it called? Not like registration, but the first like day of grad school, basically.
Like orientation.
Thank you. That's the word I'm looking for. Orientation. So as you see, I did not get my PhD because I cannot think of words. But so I got the date for orientation wrong. I thought it was on Monday and it was on a Sunday and it was welcome weekend. And I went out Saturday night and was out and closed the bars down and got – and when I got picked to go, my grades as an undergrad weren't, like, amazing. They were good, but they weren't, like, incredible. So when the director – and I guess I'm not going to name names here – but when the director of the journalism program at the time told me to apply to grad school and that I would probably get in, I was like, why? He's like, we need somebody here who got their undergrad here who can, you know, like will help continue the reputation of this program. And you were an athlete, so that helps. And I was like, I love this school. I'd love to come back for a fifth year. So I got the date wrong. So I show up, it was at 7 a.m. or 8 a.m. And I show up and I am blasted. And it's like, I got dressed in like 2 seconds and I was there and they made me give like a 5-minute speech. And I had no idea that that was coming. Just like how you said, like you were just, you got an email and you're like, I'll go. And then like, it's a big thing. That's what it reminded me of. I had to give this big speech about like the message that I dog was bad. And it was like done. And we were in this break room and one of the guys came up to me and was like, oh man, that was so awesome what you said. And really got me excited for this semester and to be here. And I'm like, good. I know in the back of my mind though, all the professors were like, who is this kid? And why is he here? But you just reminded me of that. It's a hell of a place to go. It's where if I would have got my doctorate, it's where I would have stayed. I love Athens with everything inside me, and I know that you made a big impact there. I wish that your ways of being a professor, you know, would catch on. I think in the new age and new media, because you do like I said, you do an incredible job interacting with your students. The other thing I want to say is I think it's awesome how much you support the club hockey program at, is it William Patterson where you're at now?
Yeah.
I think it's awesome how you support the club hockey program. Club hockey is so underrated as far as the quality of play. And William Patterson's one of the better D2 club teams in the nation. They actually played OU in the national tournament, I think, 2 years ago in Columbus. Actually,
this season, they just went up to D1.
Oh, did they?
So, and I actually was just at their game on Friday night. They played NYU. They lost 4-1. But it was – I went to a few of the games at OU. Obviously, I saw you play at OU. And I thought it was so fun to see that William Patterson does play Ohio every now and then. So I think my first year here, I saw there was a game. I don't know if it was William Patterson was traveling to Athens or what it was. It's very exciting just to be that close to the action. And I have a lot of my journalism students who cover the games for the school newspaper. One of them who was one of the broadcasters for the team doing the PA announcing and all that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, it's just fun to see them. They're kind of interactive on Twitter. Like, I am big on Twitter. And I had a lot of fun out there. I mean, unfortunately, they didn't win the other night. But it's one of the few times, like, at our school – since we're a commuter school, there's not a lot of events that bring us all together, but you go to those hockey games and people are with their William Patterson blankets because the ice is really cold, you know, to be near, and they're screaming for William Patterson. There's a lot of, like, you know, the girlfriends of the players or whatever, and it just adds a nice real atmosphere and makes you feel like you're part of something. Yeah. I was just telling my friend the other night, I wish I could get, like, a William Patterson hockey jersey. Apparently they don't, like, sell them, at the school or whatever, but I need to get, like, some sort of William Patterson, like, sports gear to wear, because I was just like, I always wear my Islander stuff to the William Patterson games. And usually I'm not the only one. There's other people there, but I just, like, represent hockey in general.
Right.
I need to start going to William Patterson stuff.
Yeah, like I said, club hockey just needs more support. It gets a lot now. It's gotten bigger in the last few years, but I've said it before. Guy that I interviewed a couple episodes ago just got called up to the East Coast League, played ACHA hockey at OU. It's an underrated level of play. So once again, guys, the name of the book, We Want Fish Sticks, The Bizarre and Infamous Rebranding of the New York Islanders, on Amazon now. Go get it. I just got my copy, or I ordered my copy today, because I have a flight to Tampa in 2 weeks, and I hate flying, so it's going to be perfect for my flight down and back. I think it's so cool. Like I said, all the players and the guys in the front office that you got to interview, it's a historian book, but you got a lot of, I think, really cool perspectives from different players. So, Nick, I appreciate you coming on. Congrats on all your success on the book. It's nice to finally be able to call you Dr. Hershon. You got any last words or anything you want to talk about?
No, I mean, I just appreciate it. And to be clear, since we did talk about it as being like a dissertation, even though it was written as like a quote unquote academic thing, it was clearly written to be a book. And I had even these battles with like my dissertation committee about, you know, it doesn't have academic theory, or it doesn't have a big discussion of the academic method, or all these other sorts of things we hear about, because I want it to become this book. I really want it to resonate with fans and not just be some sort of academic discussion. So just to be clear, like, yeah, it's all these stories. It is written the way like a journalist writes a good story. Thanks for having me on. You know, it's cool to see you again for the first time since probably, like, I don't know, May of 2016 or whenever it was that we last saw each other, and we're talking hockey and wrestling and all that good stuff back in the day. So yeah, it's really cool. And to think about all those good times in Athens, that was like probably some of my most fun, you know, memories of my life, honestly, is especially, I mean, well, I don't know, the whole 3 years was great, but like that last year doing this research, talking to friends who were really into it too, having great dissertation committee and all that stuff. So yeah, it was a really fun time.
Awesome, man. Well, like I said, I appreciate it. Best of luck in the future. I hope sales go through the roof for you. And I look forward to your next project for sure, buddy.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I got to see what else, what other part of Islanders history no one has tackled yet. There's been a lot of negative stuff. And like I said, I got to do something with Mario Tchaikovsky. Let's see. Maybe a Marius bio would be my next book. I don't know how many people will read it, but I'd be interested.
I love it. Well, all right, man. Thanks again. Like I said, you take care. Book is available now. Go get it on Amazon. Nick, thanks again, buddy.
Thanks a lot, Shane. Bye.